From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The history of colonization, particularly of the British Empire, often centers on armies, slavery, and exploitation. But what about food? Indeed, today, curry is considered a quintessentially British dish. Even sugar, tea, and various spices, vegetables, meats, and methods of cooking food can be traced back to the various parts of the British Empire. A new book called The Taste of Empire makes the case that food was a, quote, driving force of empire. Its author is Lizzie Collingham. She is an associate fellow at the University of Warwick. Her earlier books include The Taste of War, World War II, and The Battle for Food, and Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors. She joins me to discuss her new book, The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. Welcome to the program, Lizzie.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, obviously, the British Empire was vast. And in the United States, we, you know the part of the British Empire that impacted us. But we forget sometimes, I think, that, you know, places as far away as New Zealand were part of the empire. So how do you make the case that food was a driving force behind Britain's imperial ambitions? You know, we not just territory, but food?
Well, I think it's true. I mean, the food web that the empire weaves interconnects people from all kinds of places who have no knowledge of each other. So a Bengali peasant growing opium has no knowledge of the Fujian peasants growing tea in China, and neither of them have any knowledge of the industrial mill workers working back in England who are drinking their tea. So the food web interconnects an enormous web of people and so on. But the reason I talk food as a driving force is because one of the reasons why I wrote the book is because food, the way a society gets its food, chooses to supply itself with its food, is a really determining factor, how it structures itself. So that's really obvious if you think about Mesopotamia and the first cities or hunter-gatherers. It's clear to us that they structure their societies around gathering enough food to eat and so on. But actually bigger societies, also the British choice to go out and search for food and affects the way the society is structured until towards the end. That what happens is the entire British agricultural sector is outsourced to the empire. So instead of growing your wheat at home, you grow it on the Canadian prairies. Instead of fattening your sheep on your grasslands at home, you fatten them on New Zealand's grasslands. And so the whole world is organized around providing the British working classes in particular with enough food to work in the mills and produce cotton to sell again to the Indians and so on. So it's an enormous web, but food is an enormously important and often forgotten about driving force in all of those.
Now, it wasn't just food in terms of calories, right? There was a quest for taste, so sugar and spices and, you know, those, I guess they were considered exotic flavors that a lot of folks in Imperial Britain had never had the access to. How much of that drove the imperial ambitions of the empire?
Well, the initial force to go searching for food, I mean, actually is rather prosaic. It's cod. One of the first things they go in search of is cod off the Newfoundland shores of Canada.
Cod, like fish?
Yeah, codfish. So they're in the search for a sea route to the East Indies. They discover the Americas by accident, and they discover that the seas are so full of cod, you can almost not row a boat through the seas off Newfoundland. And so they go and catch the fish, dry them and salt them, and bring them back to feed the army and the navy, and also to sell to the Spanish and the Portuguese and the Mediterranean, people living around the Mediterranean, because they love salt fish. So that's actually a rather boring, you know, we would think of, and certainly the British hated salt cod. So that wasn't an exciting taste that they went in search of, but they certainly, they learned that that was a very good way you could swap your salt cod for wine from Spain and olive oil and currants from Italy. And so you get a triangle of trade developing. And they also, of course, they go in search of the spices in the East Indies. But very quickly, spices come pouring in to Britain, and they fall out of fashion. They're not so, they're no longer seen as coming from beyond the known world. So they're not the exciting, exotic things they once were. And so instead, actually, the spices get relegated to the provision, to making cakes and the sweets, of course. But in the search for spices, they come across tea, and that becomes an exciting, exotic drink, and then becomes very normal, and everybody drinks tea in Britain. And it's a sugar, and in Barbados, initially, the first settlers in Barbados were just looking for a cash crop, and they discovered that sugar, which is growing in Brazil, grows very well in Barbados, and so it makes them loads of money. And so sugar comes pouring into Britain, and before you know it, they started putting sugar in their tea, and it's no longer an exotic thing. That's what mill workers give themselves energy with. In that, so it goes from luxuries to necessities, or these luxurious products, exotic, exciting tastes, turn into normal everyday tastes. So the product of empire is a strange one of exotic, exciting things that then become normalized and homogenized. And so it's a process of changing tastes and spreading new tastes around the world, but also at the same time a kind of strange, paradoxical narrowing and making more mundane taste.
How was the quest for taste also linked to slavery and slave labor? How are those two things linked?
That's a very tragic aspect of it. So in Barbados, when they first started to grow sugar there, they used white indentured laborers. So the poor and the vagrants in Britain and the convicts were taken out for 5 years. They were promised if they worked for 5 years, they'd get board and lodging and maybe £10 to be able to set themselves up at the end of it with their own land and to become farmers. So that they were white indentured labourers, the first labourers on the sugar plantations. But the Portuguese slave ships would stop in Barbados on their way between West Africa and Brazil, where the sugar plantations of the Portuguese were, and they sold the slaves then to the white planters in Barbados, and that's how they discovered that there was another source of labour, and that's how black slaves become very, very crucial to the white sugar, the sugar plantations for the white planters in the West Indies. And then, of course, they're taken in the Carolinas. The first people who set up the Carolinas are actually sugar planters from Barbados, who they run out of space in Barbados. They're looking for a new land. They want to plant more sugar, but that doesn't work in the Carolinas. They end up growing rice as cash crop. Of course, they bring slaves with them and set them to work. And in fact, it's the slaves who introduce rice into the Carolinas. So it's a West African agricultural system. It's kind of picked up from one side of the Atlantic and replanted in the other side.
And how did the British Empire also, through its quest for food and feeding its own people, end up impacting the food systems of the colonies that they ruled over?
Oh, in countless ways. I mean, so the British themselves have checked, you know, their agricultural system is completely altered by this process of the 450 years. And everywhere they go, they impact. So in Ireland, they think that the Irish are barbaric because they tend to be pastoral farmers. And so they try to set about making them into wheat farmers. That doesn't work very well, but they end up introducing a very strong dairy industry, which then provides the West Indian planters growing sugar with salt, beef and butter in the West Indies. They swap the West African men for maize. So they take maize from the Americas across to West Africa and introduce it, because maize grows very well in the gap, in the period, in the growing period, like millet. And you can get two crops of maize in when you could only get one crop of millet. So it replaces indigenous crops and then becomes the staple grain of West Africa. The same thing is done in East Africa. You get many Africans thinking maize is the food of the ancestors, and it's an indigenous grain, and is seen as African, when in actual fact it's brought there by the forces of empire. Molasses in Newfoundland. So in Newfoundland they have a fish industry, and they sell the seconds of the codfish, the ones that aren't very well salted and are going off and aren't very nice, to feed the slaves who are growing the sugar in the plantations in the West Indies, and they in turn get molasses and sugar from the West Indies. And molasses becomes an absolutely such a fundamental food in Newfoundland that it's seen as, you pour molasses on everything, and that's seen as a Newfoundland food. But of course, it's not at all. Tea, I mean, tea is a Chinese herbal drink. It grows in China, and then the British take it to India, grow it in India, and but it's seen as so fundamentally British. To be British is to drink tea. To be British is, in fact, to eat the world. So they take food around, and then these foodstuffs become seen as part of national identities and become integrated in who you are and in your identity.
Right, we forget
So,
about this history a lot. I love to cook, and I read about the history of how tomatoes are not Indian at all. They were brought to India. There's so many, as an Indian cook, there are so many vegetables that Indians cook with that are not native to India that were brought there, I'm assuming, by the British from
well, I
other
think
parts
actually
of
probably
their colonies.
tomatoes probably come in from the Portuguese with the Portuguese, but it's the British who in Bengal is one of the places where tomatoes and potatoes and cauliflower, things like that, are coming. And so they set up market gardens around British settlements in India to supply the British. But of course, they then start supplying. Indians start liking them and buying them. And what's interesting is they don't cook them like the British, the Indians. They cook them like an Indian person would cook an Indian vegetable. So British vegetables or European vegetables are integrated into Indian cookery. I mean, that's a fascinating, say, way that. And chili, the chili plant isn't Indian. We think of it as Indian because it comes to Europe through from India through to Hungary, and then when it first comes into Europe that way, it's referred to as Indian pepper. But in actual fact, it comes, of course, the Portuguese bring it from Brazil into Kerala and Goa, and it starts, the chili grows really well in South India, and so it becomes part of, it's integrated into the South Indian cooking and then spreads out throughout the subcontinent. So
Right.
these plants and people move around with empire. It's an incredible force for change, changing tastes.
Right. And of course, it's unfortunately also a very sordid tale that involves slavery and famine and all of the things that go along with colonization and imperialism. Now, it's not just a story about food, as you point out in your book, it's also about drinks and drugs. Rum and the
Yes.
Americas, opium and China. How did those two aspects fit in the history of colonization? How did the British get involved, for example, in opium coming to China?
Well, opium, the British don't want to, the Chinese don't really want to buy anything the British have to offer in exchange for tea. So they want silver. And the British don't like pouring silver, in effect, to dissolve into cups of tea. So they look for another product, and they realize that the Chinese are very fond of smoking opium, not taking it as you put it in a Hubble Bobble pipe and smoke it. So they start, the East India Company decides to monopolize the growing of opium in Bengal, and then they auction it, sell it at auction to private traders who then take it across and sell it to basically smugglers just off the Chinese coast, who take it into China and exchange it for silver. Now, the idea is, the myth of the opium trade is that this was an incredible drain on the silver out of China. But in actual fact, 3/4 of the silver that the smugglers pay for the opium then goes straight back into the hands of the East India Company merchants, who plough it back into China to get tea. So it becomes a circular thing. But the problem is that the Chinese, there's a debate within the Chinese. They don't want their country to trade, so all the Western traders are confined to one port in Canton. And there's an argument, and they're not sure about whether this is a good idea to allow so many Western influence. So there's a big movement to try and close off trade, and another movement trying to open trade and say, if we legalize opium within our country, it will take the rug out from under the smugglers' feet. We'll be able to control the trade. Unfortunately, the ones who want to legalize the trade don't win, and instead a chap is sent to Canton. He seizes all the opium from the British traders, and it leads to the opium wars and the forcing open of 9 more treaty ports in China. And right. This is seen as a terrible situation, and the Chinese demonize opium and see it as this terrible demon drug, because it becomes a symbol of their humiliation at the hands of the colonizers. In actual fact, smoking opium actually isn't particularly bad for you if you smoke it. The worst it can do is make you constipated, actually. And the Chinese, I know, it's not particularly glamorous. And the Chinese, the Chinese blame it for, in actual, they're using it to suppress appetite. So many of the people who travel to China and see these, what they call ravaged opium addicts, actually what they're seeing is people who are suffering from famine, who are smoking opium to suppress the hunger pangs that are hurting.
Wow. All for the British thirst for tea, which is part of the story that we're talking about with my guest, Lizzie Collingham. Her book is The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. I want to close with asking you to talk about the fact that you have incorporated recipes into your book, which is quite fascinating. Tell us about that aspect of your book.
Well, I always think recipes are a bit like a quotation. So if you can look at a recipe, you could, particularly a contemporary recipe, you get a feel for the place and the way, and the language, and the way people thought. Recipes aren't recipes that we use now. My favourite one is actually the one for laudanum, which is to take a few drops of laudanum and put it in alcohol before the fire. And that's such an odd recipe that would never occur in a recipe book now. And the way they express themselves, so it takes you into the period. And so I think they're like little windows into the past.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Lizzie. Good luck to you, and thanks for spending this time with us.
Thank you very much.
Lizzie Collingham is an associate fellow at the University of Warwick. Her earlier books include The Taste of War, World War II and the Battle for Food, and Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors. We're discussing her new book, The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.